This informative podcast is brought to you by the Health Ranger Store. Visit healthrangerstore.com/science for a selection of science-backed, laboratory-tested superfoods and nutritional products. Thank you for your support. Welcome, everyone. This is Mike Abbott, the Health Ranger for naturalnews.com. And today I'm joined by Dr. Andrew Wakefield. He's the author of Callous Disregard, the book that talks about how the scientific community is intentionally, willfully disregarding an enormous amount of evidence that should raise concern about the possible links between routine vaccinations and harmful health side effects being experienced by children especially, but even beyond children, adults, and senior citizens as well. And today, we're not going to talk about vaccines so much. We're going to talk about science and journalism and the intersection of those two concepts. And we'll bring in some of the history of science. And to set that conversation going, I would like to welcome you, Dr. Wakefield, for joining me today.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
And I will call you Andy.
Thank you.
Thanks for allowing me to do that. I want to throw something out here about the history of science and scientific revolutions. And what I see as your current situation reflecting some of what we've seen throughout history. I'm going to cite two specific examples. And this might be a bit lengthy, so bear with me on this. But if we go back to, of course, Galileo in the 1600s, and Galileo presided over really a transition in human understanding. There was, before Galileo's time, it was the era of the heliocentric view of the universe. The Earth-centric view. The Earth is the center of the universe and the planets and the sun revolve around the Earth. This was believed by and enforced by, of course, the Catholic Church, which was the institution of knowledge in that day. And they were very forceful about this. They called Galileo's research and his writings heretical. They said that his information was false. He was attacked. He was vilified. He was denounced. And yet he was right, because we now know, of course, the sun is the center of our solar system. And after, 1610, 1615, when he was first accused and vilified. Oh, and by the way, he was sentenced to life with house arrest by the church, so he was punished for his entire life for daring to tell the truth. And after that, of course, we were able to truly move into the heliocentric model of understanding of at least heavenly bodies within our solar system, and that's now accepted as fact. I see this controversy surrounding you as ultimately opening doors to this new era of understanding, which is a more holistic understanding of the human body, neurology, mind-body connection, that is, how does even the mind affect the gastrointestinal function? How can the body be supported in its ability to heal itself? And vaccines may indeed have a role still in the future, but they are not the center of the focus of health. Now, with that said, I know I've said a lot here. What are your comments on the history of science, the role that you find yourself in right now, the position you're in right now, and what you think may unfold from this in a shift in human understanding about health?
Well, I think the issue is one of perception and a different perception of the world that we held to be true and the world that we now know. And I don't pretend for a moment to know the truth. Galileo was doing with a more exact science, physics, and he was clearly in a position to state the facts. Now, I don't know the truth about what's going on with vaccines and autism because it's so complex. And I tell my students that I don't know the truth. Half of what I'm telling you is true and half of it is not, but I don't know which half is which. So it's your job as young emerging scientists, physicians, to question that and resolve which aspects are true and which aren't. And medicine, first of all, needs to have a level of humility that allows that debate to take place. I think Václav Pavel, the Czech playwright and the later the Prime Minister of the Czech Republic, said, "Follow the man who seeks the truth and run from the man who's found it." And there are many on the other side of the equation, the vaccine believers, if you like, who know the truth. They know there is no danger from vaccination, that autism is not caused by vaccination. They know. And when they know, that's a very, very dangerous situation, because they do not know. Now, coming back to your original point, is that it depends on your perception of infectious agents. What an infection is, what a bacterium or a virus is. And I've grown to have a huge respect for these things over the years. We are here on this earth now because of infection. Not in spite of it, because of it. Our immune system has been fashioned, shaped, designed over millions of years since we first emerged from the primordial soup as single-celled organisms, to evolve a hugely complex immune system that is a result of its interaction, its education with infectious agents. They are the prime factor in developing our immune responsiveness and our repertoire. And having fashioned something like that over such a long time, to see infection in one way and then suddenly see it in an entirely different way, for example, by going from a respiratory route of infection to a natural virus, to an injected form of an infection, from going from a different strain, a different route, a different dose of infection, and a different mean population age of exposure to infection. So kids used to get mumps at 7 to 10 years of age, now they get it 18 months. Mm-hmm. When you change that subtle ecological balance, which has evolved over such a long time, it is no wonder that you are going to see, have unexpected, unintended consequences, and you need to be aware of that. The other thing, of course, is that we've now come to learn that so many infections, or so many infectious or potentially infectious agents, are actually beneficial. We require them for education of our gut immune system. The exposure of the gut, the colonization of the gut to gut flora very early on is a major determinant of how our immune system health evolves. Now, if you are a mother who gives birth via the vaginal route, your child, your infant, will acquire your gut flora. And that is likely to be healthy gut flora, at least historically. If you are born by cesarean section in hospital, then you will acquire hospital flora instead of your maternal gut flora. You won't see the consequences of that in the short term, but what we now know is that that creates a differential risk for example, Crohn's disease, later bowel diseases, and potentially other problems. So the way in which you are initially colonized by bacteria can have profound effects on how your immune system is educated, and thereby your later risk of seemingly unrelated diseases. So I've become a great, great respecter of infectious agents and their ability to elude us, to cause problems that we did not expect. And if we believe in our exquisite arrogance that we can exploit them, manipulate them in the test tube, give them back to people and exploit them in a way that we call attenuated, then the virus will laugh at us. It will simply laugh, because it has a collective intelligence that will not allow that to happen. There's a very good example that's just as emerging literally today in the medical literature. And this is related to, I believe, a pneumococcus, which has, by virtue of the selective pressures placed upon it by antibiotics on the one hand and immunization on the other hand, has now eluded those. Its infectivity, the dangers that infection poses have changed in the face of selective genetic pressures that we have put on it to elude protection from antibiotics and vaccines.
Sure.
We have forced the genetic pace. We force the genetic change. So what happens? What happens?
You get a superbug.
Yeah, and the manufacturers say, wow, we better make a vaccine against that one.
Right.
And then the next one. You're fighting mutations that are more intelligent, collectively more intelligent, more adaptable, and ultimately can cause what we don't know. But you also create a population that now becomes dependent on vaccination. Not just the first vaccine, but the second and the third and the fourth and the fifth, and it never ends. You create a population that is dependent on immunization.
Because now you've shifted the wild, what's in the wild, where it used to be a mild virus that could be handled by a regular person's immune system. Now in the wild, you have these super virulent strains, and it can happen with bacteria, of course, too, as you're hinting at. And then, like you say, now you're dependent on these vaccines, and the vaccine companies have wrapped up a revenue model that really works for their interests, but denies the people the health that they were seeking in the first place.
Yes, what happens to a population that becomes dependent for its very survival on vaccines? Who are we and our children and grandchildren then beholden to?
Exactly.
And are the people that we're beholden to, the pharmaceutical industry, are they actually capable of anticipating what that bacteria or virus is going to do next?
Well, no.
No, because they've never thought about it in the first place. So we're creating a marketplace, we're creating a wonderful revenue model, and we are creating a potential time bomb for the population.
All right, I really like the fact that you're talking about the coexistence of humans with microbiology, bacteria and viruses. And this, it seems like the germ theory of disease has come from a camp of thinking that for a long time has thought that human beings need to live in a sterilized environment, that the germs are always the enemy, and that we must essentially carpet bomb the human body with antibiotics, for example, or other chemicals in order to rid them of bacteria or viruses. But we also see this, interestingly, in the food supply, where there's this ongoing effort to really sterilize food. For example, the debate about raw milk versus pasteurized milk happening right now. There's the debate about where the FDA wants to irradiate spinach and onions and all of these fresh items in order to eliminate the bacteria. But there's also the issue of the soil that the food is grown in. And when you apply things like Roundup, which are applied to these genetically modified crops, these Roundup ready crops, you do to the soil what antibiotics do to the human gut. So you eliminate the healthy flora in the soil, you create a weakened biodiversity in the soil, which then means the soil and the plants are very susceptible to disease. And that reflects exactly what happens in human beings, doesn't it?
I think nature abhors a vacuum. Infections abhor a vacuum. They will find a way. There's a wonderful line in Jurassic Park, I don't know if you remember it, but the chaos theory mathematician guy, he's in the lab and the Chinese guy is showing him the raptor and he says, don't worry, they're all female. And he says, you don't understand. Nature will find a way. Nature finds a way. It's a great line. I love that line. It says it all for me. Nature will find a way. And of course it did in Michael Crichton's book and the movie.
Yes.
But nature will find a way. You cannot sterilize the world, nor should you. And you're right, this whole notion of the germ theory has to be radically modified in light of what we now know, so that we have scientists who acknowledge this, widely acknowledged, that this ecological interaction, this fundamental and very, very essential ecological interaction between man and microbe or plant and microbe, is vital.
Mm-hmm.
But you have a commercial imperative which pays no heed to that at all.
Right.
Now, I mean, this ecological interaction is one that's fascinating to me, because you might ask, well, why are bugs dangerous? Why do bugs hurt some people and not others? And there's this fascinating observation from the steppes of Outer Mongolia, where it's inhabited by ground squirrels, millions and millions and millions of ground squirrels. And in some areas of the steppes, they will they all carry in their throat the organism of plague, Yersinia pestis. But in some areas of the steppes, these animals live year on year with no problem at all. Mm-hmm. They carry this organism in their throat and it's no problem. And then just down the road, they will die in their millions in epidemics of plague every year. Mm-hmm. Why? Why the difference? Why the difference?
The
same organism, same
vulnerability.
Same and what the Moscow Institute of Ecology and Evolution thought, well, is it possible that it's the metal content of the forage plants that they're eating? Is it that there are toxic metals or deficiencies of beneficial metals like zinc in the forage plants that are interacting to change either the organism itself or the host's immune response, the ground squirrel's immune response to the organism that is making it either a killer or not? Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what they found. So they found that if there were high levels of toxic metals like cadmium in the forage plants, then that organism, Yersinia pestis, killed. Hmm. If there was a deficiency of zinc, that organism killed. If there were no toxic metals and there was zinc, the animals lived without any problem at all. That organism and the animal sat there year on year, no problem.
So potentially we see this reflected in vaccines with, well, there's the mercury in some vaccines, there's the aluminum. Well, formaldehyde's not a metal, but potentially another neurotoxin. Well, certainly another neurotoxin. Do you think that might be some of what is causing vaccinated children to be susceptible to future infection?
It's my belief that that is fundamental to it. Absolutely fundamental to it. Why? Because we know in laboratory settings, if you, for example, take an animal that is genetically resistant to leishmaniasis, they develop an immune response that protects them. Mm-hmm. If you then take that animal and give them subtoxic doses of mercuric chloride, I'm not sure what a subtoxic dose of mercuric chloride is, I don't think one exists, but levels which do not produce the recognized effects of acute mercury toxicity, and then you expose that animal to leishmaniasis, it will develop autoimmune disease and die. So this is not a vague notion that is something that's idiosyncratic to the steppes of Outer Mongolia. This is something that is repeated time and time again in the laboratory. We see it with Coxsackie virus and myocarditis. So it is seen time and time again. Is it happening in reality in children? Well, let's look at that. You're taking children and you're giving them ethyl mercury from day one in the 1990s in this country, or indeed now in pregnant women in the influenza vaccine.
Incredible.
And you are potentially, very likely, biologically plausibly poisoning the immune system of those individuals, biasing it towards an immune response that is not protective against viral infections. And then you're giving live viruses. What is the outcome of that going to be? And you take aluminum. Aluminum is known to influence the immune system in the same way. Indeed, that's why it's there. It's there to promote an antibody response, a response which does not bias the immune system towards protection from intracellular organisms like viruses. You are deliberately doing it. So when you then give a live viral vaccine, what is the compound effect of that? When you're giving them all at the same time, what is the compound effect of that? No one knows. Why? Because no one's looked. Why? Because no one cares enough. That's why.
It's not okay to look at that. That whole issue is off limits, at least under the current scientific regime. But you hinted at the vulnerabilities. And it strikes me that even when it comes to seasonal flu, many people call it the winter flu, people normally don't think about, well, why is it the winter flu? Why is it not the summer flu? It doesn't occur to most folks, I think, that this virus is circulating really all year long. It's in the wild, it's actively mutating, it's actively germinating in a few people throughout the entire year. Why does it strike so much in the winter? And why does it only strike in January and February in North America, where it's July and August in Australia, which is in the Southern Hemisphere? And then I think finally, if people can really look at that, they begin to get these, to link it up to one of the elements being vitamin D deficiency, sunlight exposure, but also potentially cold weather creating stresses on the body and so on. But it seems like science, the conventional science, has discounted the role of the host, the health of the host, the terrain, if you will, in whether or not a disease is acquired or defended against.
Now, science has tried to, or commercial interests have tried to usurp the role of the host. Whether they acknowledge it or not, they don't care about it because they want to control it.
Yes.
If we can give vaccines to induce an immune response that protects, that's great. We've got ourselves a marketplace. Now, a lot of this is not done with malice aforethought. A lot of this is not done with an intent to harm. The problem is, and so therefore the argument is not anti-vaccine. The argument is for a safety-first vaccine agenda. Mm. The argument is saying, do not take these agents, these infectious agents, these noxious agents, these toxins, these known toxins for granted. Do not make assumptions about them, particularly when you're using them in combination, because they will produce untoward effects that you don't even expect, that you're not looking for. You haven't got on your list of adverse reactions that are known to be caused by this virus. You won't find them because they're not there. Because you have changed the whole interaction between the infectious agent or the neurotoxin, the immunotoxin, and the immune system. That's what you've changed. But something so fundamental.
Indeed, it is fundamental. But the attitude of most conventional physicians who are promoting these vaccines, and certainly the vaccine companies themselves and government health authorities to a large extent, is that there's absolutely nothing to worry about. They know with certainty, there's no risk. They're perfectly safe. The studies have been done. You know, stop asking questions. You're crazy to ask questions. I mean, people who ask questions are being called flat earth believers now. To ask a question, a scientific question. Why is there so much arrogance from those who are promoting the vaccines? Why do they not have the humility and the scientific integrity to step back and be willing to assess some honest questions, some questions of concern from intelligent people?
It's a very good point, and I think you have to bear in mind that we lived with 20 years of tobacco science that said it was safe, mm-hmm. or indeed it was good for you. And you had physicians on television promoting brands of cigarettes.
Journal of the American Medical Association.
Absolutely. This is where we come from. We are not as sophisticated as we like to think we are. We are prone to influences, to biases, to belief systems that fit with our own comfort level. Mm. And people portray themselves as scientists. I talk to many, many scientists, many physicians whose children are affected by autism following vaccines, who say, we know there is a problem, but we don't dare step out of line. Hmm. We look at what happened to you, and we don't dare to step out of line. Now, evil can really only prevail when good men stand by and do nothing. I mean, to paraphrase the saying, that is unacceptable. That is unacceptable. What you are, in effect, doing, if that's what you truly believe, that your child was damaged or you know there is injury, then you're taking your 30 pieces of silver, frankly.
Yes.
It's not good enough to deny your own child, to stand back and say, well, I know what happened, but I can't talk about this. And I do meet these people all the time. And to me, that's unacceptable. Because the future of this country, the future of the world, depends upon the well-being of our children. And well, that's a simple fact.
You quoted Edmund Burke there, I believe, correct? I think that's who he's from. A British philosopher, an English philosopher. And if you get into the philosophy of this, which is really what I wanted to ask you about in this segment, is science, in order for it to continue to have value as one valuable method in the search of understanding, and it is a very valuable mechanism, but I would say it's not the only one. There are other methods for understanding, but science is certainly the predominant method used in our civilization to gain understanding about at least the material world around us and how things work. But for this branch of understanding to continue to have to have credibility, mustn't it stick to the tenets of science, which is that we will make these observations, we will assess the data, we will arrive at conclusions based on the data, not based on our preconceived notions and our wishes and what we want to happen, and that we will present the findings based on the data and so on. But this entire process has been abandoned in the quest to attack you. And if they're going to do it to you, they could do it to anyone. Is no scientist safe today from the politicizing, the political agenda of a particular branch of medicine?
No, absolutely not. We are so vulnerable. We're vulnerable because we have sold out, in many cases, to the pharmaceutical industry and to the sort of pharma government complex. Medical schools are dependent upon their funding, in large part from the pharmaceutical industry or pharmaceutical industry influences. And this is dancing with the devil in respect of the way in which science should be conducted and the influences placed upon it. So I was part of a medical school at one stage that went into what they called a strategic alliance with a pharmaceutical company. What does that mean? It means that you get a certain amount of money, which sounds very impressive to you, but is small change for the pharmaceutical industry, that gives them the option to exploit whatever is produced within that medical school. And these negotiations took place for some time. Whether they were actually finally concluded or not, I don't know, because I left before that happened. But what it also means is, if things are happening that you do not like as that company, that are not in your interests, then they're not going to happen.
Right.
This is exactly what happened to me, that there were constraints placed upon my research, my valid vaccine safety research, because in the UK, actually, the government had done a deal with the pharmaceutical industry that meant that the government had picked up their liability for a knowingly dangerous measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. Mm. And this issue you've read in the book is that they licensed a vaccine in July of 1997, which had in that same month been withdrawn in Canada for safety reasons. They knew it was not safe. It was cheaper. They put price before the well-being of children. Now, we've seen time and time again the corruption, the abuse of science, and it's happening largely on one side of this equation. You are told time and time again there are 14, 17, 20 millions of papers which exonerate the vaccine. Say, for example, there's no link between mercury, thimerosal preservative, and vaccinations. In fact, when the data are analyzed, when the studies are looked at comprehensively, 74% of those studies' published data support a link between mercury and autism, 74%. And since then, that paper was published, two more have come out supporting it as well. So that's taking up to 80% of the published literature supports a link between mercury and vaccines and autism.
Right.
And yet, the public are being told through this vast public relations machine that the science is over, it's ruled it out.
Right.
No. And when you take the science that proposes it is ruled out and reanalyze it correctly, which Dr. DeSoto did from the University of Northern Iowa, it showed exactly the opposite effect. And the scientists who wrote the original paper had to change their findings and conclusions. Mm. They had not analyzed the data properly. So science in the private interest, I'm afraid, is damaging for the people. And that's what we're seeing at the moment.
Indeed, the corporate-run agenda of science. But what you just said reminds me of another historical event that's highly relevant here. I know we're a little long on this segment, but I want to ask you about this one. And this is not to do with medicine. This has to do with physics and fusion. In 1989, Fleischmann and Pons, out of the University of Utah, Provo, I believe, they presented their findings that they had created what they called cold fusion, which we now know as low-energy nuclear reactions, or LENR. And this announcement that you could create fusion at tabletop temperatures, room temperatures, was considered so outrageous that the entire physics community, virtually the entire community, the conventional physics community, they convened a panel, which was, of course, stacked with hot fusion research professors and people who take grant money from the government, which has been tens of billions of dollars, of course, over the years. And they still haven't produced hot fusion energy, by the way, in all those years. But they then concluded that Fleischmann and Pons had that were engaged in fraud. They said, these people are complete quacks. They couldn't have possibly done this cold fusion experiment. It's not real. It's a complete fraud. It's a hoax. And the media jumped on this too, jumped all over it. Now, fast forward 20 years. Last year, the U.S. Navy announced that it had successfully replicated and was researching low-energy nuclear reactions, cold fusion, in order to power submarines. Hundreds of labs around the world have reproduced this over the years, especially in Japan, a nation that doesn't have fossil fuels and is, of course, very interested in a low-impact source of energy. Low-energy nuclear reactions are real. They are part of physics. They're proven. There are helium elements being produced in this that are clear evidence of low-energy nuclear reactions taking place. It's not a tabletop nuke, but the science is solid now. So all of these physicists in 1989 that accused Fleischmann and Pons and destroyed their reputations, destroyed their careers, and had them essentially kicked out of the university system, well, those physicists were wrong. Not only were they wrong, I would say they were damn wrong. I mean, they were so wrong, and they cost two men their professional careers. Obviously, there are reflections of this happening today with you and the accusations that are being leveled against you, and it would seem like the conventional doctors who are, and even non-doctors, the journalist, the blogger, Brian Deer, who are leveling these accusations against you should have studied history, should have had some understanding of the context of what they're doing, but they don't. They're so certain they're right.
Yes, I think the great artists, and please, I'm not likening myself to great artists, but the great, great artists in history became famous after they died. You know, Van Gogh, you know, you hope that there's a heaven. You hope that he can look down and say, wow, the lilies just sold for six. That's great. It's great. I knew one day they would. It's a fact of life. If you're going to get involved in this kind of debate, then you, as the scientist, need to study the history of medicine, the history of science as well, and understand this is the fate of many, many people who go out on a limb, who make extraordinary claims. That's what's going to happen. You mustn't expect to be exonerated in your lifetime or ever, but you must stick to the scientific principle and pursue the hypothesis until its natural conclusion and not abandon it because you're put under political or financial or other pressures, if you can. Now, there is an additional imperative for a physician to do it who is looking at these children, and that is that every time one of them walks past my door, I don't have a problem. I don't have a problem. This child has a problem. He has a problem that I can help develop an understanding of and help him, I hope. But I don't have a problem. As long as I don't suffer from the vainglorious belief that this is all going to be resolved in my lifetime, uh-huh. I hope it is for the sake of these children. But I'm so far beyond that notion that I need some kind of redemption from the American Academy of Pediatrics or the Lancet.
Right.
I don't. These are instruments of a state that I don't really want to be associated with. I would like to stick to the principles of medical science, and that's my job, and I won't be deterred from that. And I don't mean that to sound sanctimonious, but for those cold fusion scientists who 20 years ago had their careers destroyed, you know, now they can reflect. They can say, we were right. They may have suffered hugely in the interim, but they also should have anticipated that that was the kind of treatment they might have got. Now, I'm with them. I mean, I'm right with them. They did a great job. But it is the fate of frontiersmen that is what they are going to suffer.
I think it is worth noting that repeatedly in your book, in your work, in this interview, that you prioritize this seeking of knowledge for the health of the children. That I've done a lot of research on your background as well before we got together here. I've never seen you as a person who was motivated primarily by dollars or pounds. It wasn't a financial motivation for you. You were always seeking to help children. In fact, it seems to me that you were almost forced into this by a sense of duty to the children. When the parents were calling you across England and they were asking you for answers, you simply followed the evidence and began to try to help them in the best way you could by seeking answers to those questions. You weren't rounding up people for these trials. They were practically pulling you in this direction. Please help me. Please help my children. And to this day, many of the parents still say, thank God for Dr. Andrew Wakefield, because he was the only one who listened to me.
Well, I think it is such a compelling story. My duty, first and foremost, as a physician, is to listen to the person on the other side of the desk, the person who's asking for my help. And these are parents who needed help. Their children were badly, badly broken. Could I offer help? I don't know, but I was not going to leave any stone unturned until I determined whether I could or not. That was my duty. Now, what's interesting is that as far as the General Medical Council were concerned, if when those parents said, Dr. Wakefield, this is what's happened to my child, please help, I said, well, I've heard your story and I'm very sympathetic, but actually, could you just shut the door and go away and not trouble me, because this could be bad for my career? Ironically, they would have preferred. That would have been more acceptable in the eyes of the General Yes. Medical Council, who are ostensibly there to protect patients. That would have been preferable to them, Indeed. For me to do that, to walk away, but not to me.
Well, folks, you've been listening to an interview here with Dr. Andrew Wakefield, and if you don't mind, I'll hold up your book here. Callous Disregard is the name of the book. You can find this at bookstores online and brick-and-mortar stores everywhere. Also, we will talk with Dr. Andrew Wakefield here in the next segment about what parents can do and what he is doing to volunteer his efforts to help parents and children attempt to overcome some of the symptoms that are now associated with the label of autism. We'll get into that in the next segment. Thank you, Dr. Wakefield, for joining me today.
Thank you.
When it comes to real science behind nutritional supplements and personal care products, even superfoods and nutrients, nobody pays as much attention to what's in your products as we do at healthrangerstore.com. We have an in-house laboratory, ISO accredited. We do mass spec testing for heavy metals, herbicides like glyphosate, bacteria, microbiology testing, including E. coli and salmonella, yeast and mold, and others. We do extensive testing, and we reject 80% of the raw materials lots that we test. And we only use the top 20% that pass our stringent requirements for ultra clean food, supplements, personal care products, and green living home products like eco-friendly laundry detergent, body soaps, dishwasher detergent, things for your home, things for your body, things that are good for the environment and good for you, and that we can verify through our science, because our position is we don't trust any supplier of raw materials. We've been in this industry for long enough to know that there's all kinds of organic fraud, counterfeit certifications, fake claims, and just a lack of basic testing out there. Heavy metals inundate the supply of superfoods, and even organics often will contain glyphosate and other toxic herbicides and pesticides. That's why we do this testing. We've learned not to trust any source in the industry, and that it takes determined, consistent testing to produce clean products. And that's why people shop with us. That's why we have over 100,000 customers at healthrangerstore.com who have come to trust us, to trust our lab testing, to know that we provide the world's cleanest foods, supplements, and superfoods using today's best science, the best, the most expensive scientific instruments in the world, triple quad mass spectrometry, ICP-MS for heavy metals analysis. We also have single quad mass specs and other instruments, time of flight, tandem mass spec time of flight instrument, and other things. To get our lab tested products, just go to healthrangerstore.com/science.
That's healthrangerstore.com/science. There you'll find hundreds of products that have been laboratory tested, verified for your safety and efficacy and product honesty. Again, that URL, type it into your browser, is healthrangerstore.com/science. We do extensive testing, like no one. No one does this, and especially not Amazon, where they sell products that are loaded with toxic lead and high levels of aluminum that are off the charts that you can't even believe. I mean, if you want to eat lead and aluminum, buy supplements from Amazon. But if you want good science-backed clean food and clean supplements, you get that from healthrangerstore.com. That's what people have come to know us for providing, and that's why people keep coming back to us. We are dedicated to this testing, and we continue to make investments in our laboratory facilities to bring you the cleanest, most verified nutritional products in the world. No one else does what we do. No one. We are leading the world in clean food, and you can take advantage of that right now at healthrangerstore.com. I'm Mike Adams, the Health Ranger. I thank you for your support. There's much more to come. The more you support us, the more we can produce content to help educate the world and uplift people through natural solutions based on nutrition and superfoods, disease prevention, cognitive enhancement, anti-aging technology, and much more. Thank you for your support.